date now and now and date and date. Who came first? Napoleon at first. Who came first? Napoleon the first. Who came first? Napoleon first. Presently. Exactly do they do. First, exactly. Do
Welcome they back. Do. And the Ukraine is more complex than we think. And we're going to talk about that complexity now. We see what's on most of the news, but there's a history here. There is a whole lot more that meets the eye than what we usually talk about in the media. We're going to get to that this hour with our guests. We're here with Dr. Taras Kuzio, who is a research associate at the Center for Political and Regional Studies, the Canadian Institute for Ukrainian Studies, University of Alberta, non-resident fellow at the Center for Transatlantic Relations, School of Advanced International Studies at Johns Hopkins University, Sam Faddis, retired CIA operations officer, author of numerous books, including the latest, his novel Kaffa, John Quigley, professor emeritus in law at The Ohio State University in 1994-95, served as an expert on the OSCE and facilitating dialogue between government authorities in Ukraine and Crimea on the constitutional status of Crimea. And Sam Faddis, John Quigley, and Dr. Taras Kuzio, welcome. Good to have the three of you with us.
Welcome. Hi.
So let me begin with you, John Quigley. I was reading some of the things you wrote, and I want to really get to the heart of this and go back to some history in a moment with the three of you. But what we see in most of the media at the moment is not kind of talking about the complexity of who is actually in power sitting in Kiev right now and what this kind of complex dynamic is all about.
Well, I think it's not very clear exactly who's in power, and I think that's what the Russian population of Ukraine is really worried about, as to who will wind up controlling the country. There is a rather well-organized rightist movement, very nationalistic Ukrainian movement that is not likely to be very friendly to the Russian population if it gets a role in government. I think it remains to be seen how that's going to play out.
One of the things, Taras Kuzio, that I think that we're not seeing here is that This is a combination of, it seems, and we'll talk about this in a moment, meddling from the West, especially the U.S., meddling from Russia, the desires of the Ukrainian people to be Ukrainian, but there's this whole mix of extreme right-wing nationalism that has a hold in Ukraine. And from people I've talked to, articles I've read from people there, that a lot of this is kind of pushed out some of the more both establishment and anti-establishment democratic elements. This is what I'm talking about in terms of complexity we're seeing now. This is not as simple as a good guy versus a bad guy.
I think that's right, and that's why I say it remains to be seen how it's going to play out.
Gentlemen, let me just one at a time. Let me let Taras jump in and then come back to John and bring Sam in. I'm sorry, Taras, go ahead.
Your previous speaker was wrong to talk about Russians. We're talking about Russian speakers, not ethnic Russians. The only region of Ukraine with an ethnic Russian majority is the Crimea. Ukraine is linguistically divided, as are quite a few countries in Europe. But this is wrong to portray this as a competition or a conflict between Ukraine and Russian speakers. If you watch YouTube, and you understand those languages, you will see that as many people speak Russian in amongst the protesters as speak Ukrainian. So it is more a question of national identity. And some parts of eastern Ukraine, such as Donetsk and Crimea, where former President Yanukovych had his strongholds, hold a very strong Soviet. It's not a question of Russian identity, it's Soviet identity. And this is counterposed to a more Ukrainian and stroke European. But amongst the Ukrainian-European identity, you can have both Russian and Ukrainian speakers. Now, the far right, of course, are there because the previous president undertook a lot of policies which were quite hostile to Ukrainian national identity and language, which had been promoted over the last 20 years. Ukrainian language was subjected to Russification in the Soviet Union. And so they are there on the ground. But, I mean, I would ask any of your listeners to go to Google Images and do a search for the protests, and you'll see that the average protester could be a middle-aged woman, an old-age pensioner, a young student, These are not all sort of skinhead football hooligans rampaging around Kiev. You have a very broad range of people, and if you just assume these are crazy nationalists, you're really missing the point. People were fed up to the teeth with a kleptocratic, violent regime that acted more like an occupation army than a legitimate government, that began to massacre its own peoples, and as plans were revealed yesterday in the Ukrainian media, they had planned to do an even bigger massacre, but that was thankfully stopped. So this is far more broader. As for the far right, well, there are approximately five opposition leaders now, with Yulia Tymoshenko, the imprisoned leader, being released from jail. Only one of the five is a leader of a nationalist party. He, who is called Oleg Tyagnobok, has absolutely zero chance of becoming president. He has about 5% support. So the person who's going to be president is going to be somebody who's from the moderate camp, say Yulia Tymoshenko, who's, by the way, from East Ukraine, the international boxer Vitali Klitschko. It's not going to be a crazy nationalist.
Right, let me go back to John. I'm going to get Sam back in here as well. We only have like 15 minutes or so left here. So, John, would you please come back in? You were trying to say something as well here.
Yes. Well, I think that's right, that it's likely that whoever emerges as the leader in the new government is going to be more of the Tymoshenko stripe than of the extreme nationalist stripe, but that element is still going to be there in the picture, and I think that's very concerning to the Russian population.
Sam, what I'm curious from your analysis in terms of security, why you see this as important and not important for the West and the rest of us here to care about?
Well, I think that what we have here is a situation which is first and foremost directly related to Vladimir Putin and the Russians and the sort of ongoing effort to cobble back together some semblance of a Soviet empire. I think that's probably a little bit too strong, but clearly that has been an ongoing effort to reassert control and influence in areas that the Russians lost influence after the fall of the Soviet Union. The Russians are not going to take kindly to this for a whole variety of reasons. They've made that crystal clear already. And I think it's a very big question as to exactly what the Russians are going to do. I mean, there is some possibility of military intervention. I would not think that would be the first thing that I would be concerned about. What I would expect rather than that would be that as the attention of the world shifts elsewhere, that they are going to do what they often do, which is come in and strong arm a lot of people and lean on a lot of people and exert a lot of influence and try to do everything they can to steer this in a direction that they're much more comfortable with.
But let me again push this out, what I raised earlier, because I've been reading a lot about this from different parts here, and when we talk about the role of the West, which I want to get to in a second, I want to come back to where we kind of picked up with the right wing. And I heard what you were saying, Taras, but let me push a little bit here with both you and John and Sam, that they will not win an election, but they have huge power and always have had power in the Ukraine in terms of sentiments among the Ukrainian people. Whether it was World War II or before World War II, in the pogroms, it's always been there. And that reports I'm reading in some of the press are saying that the people who took over the palace, that the people who led the last demonstrations that ended the kind of a possibility of elections and figuring out a way to get through this peacefully were these nationalists who do seem at this moment to have a lot of power. Whether or not they can win an election or maintain power, that force is there and significant. Taras.
I think your report is wrong. They've never had power in Ukraine. The first time a nationalist party entered the Ukrainian parliament was in 2012 when the Svoboda, which is Freedom Party, won 10%. As per throughout Europe, by the way, Ukraine's nationalist populists are some of the weakest in Europe. If you look around most West European countries, especially Austria, where you have 30% of the vote going to these kind of parties, The only reason they came into the Ukrainian parliament was in opposition to various policies pursued by the government, because these kind of parties thrive as protest parties. So this is the first time they've entered the Ukrainian parliament, so I don't understand why you're saying they've always been around. Ukraine has had four presidents until now. Only one of them could be dubbed in some ways a more Ukrainian nationalist to some degree, and that was Viktor Yushchenko. But the three others were by no means linked to some kind of Ukrainian nationalism. But could I just mention something on the intervention? I think it's what we need to put into context is the exaggerated journalistic kind of reporting about this being a geopolitical contest. I know this, it reads great in the media when you talk about this kind of thing, but neither Obama or the European Union ever wanted to compete with Russia for Ukraine. That was more in line with the Bush-Cheney administration rather than Obama. So they've been very reluctant in, people coming in, and they certainly haven't been meddling. Russia, yes, Vladimir Putin will take this extremely personal, because this is a double whammy for him. In 2004 and in 2013-14, he's backed the wrong horse. And so he's been personally humiliated on two occasions. Now, he has a very Soviet mentality, so he assumes that the CIA, the U.S. are behind these protesters. But that's simply wrong. The protesters were very organic civil society. The idea that the U.S. pumped in loads of money is simply just wrong. On military intervention, just quickly, Ukraine, it's unlikely that Russia is going to move in like in Georgia in 2008. What is more likely is that you already have people on the ground from the Black Sea Fleet in the Crimea. You don't need external intervention. There's large numbers of sailors and marines there. There's the military intelligence, GRU, FSB. They have always supported Crimean separatists in a variety of ways, and in 2009 this led to the expulsion of two Russian diplomats.
Right.
So that's where the danger is, certainly the Crimea.
John, your thoughts on this, and then back to Sam.
Yes, well, I think the United States was trying to play a hand. I agree it didn't play a decisive hand. I agree that the changes have come about from domestic forces in Ukraine. But Victoria Nuland's conversation with the U.S. ambassador in Kiev, the one that was put on YouTube, indicated that she was trying to manipulate the government in a way that would be unfavorable to Yanukovych. And as for Crimea, when I was there in 1994, people were asking me about self-determination and whether they had a right to self-determination to figure out what their status should be. And so I think it's not crazy for the people in Crimea to say, you know, we should be able to determine what our political future should be. And if we don't want to be with Ukraine, that should be our prerogative.
So, Sam, in your analysis, where do you think where this is going to end up, and what effect it will have on both Europe and Russia and Ukraine? What's your analysis?
You know, I think I'm going to make an analogy, and any analogy like this is going to be way too simplistic and brush over a lot of differences. But I think if you think about what we saw in Egypt with this so-called Arab Spring, that one of the things hopefully we have learned from that is that the really critical time is not when everybody's out in the square demonstrating. The really critical time comes when that's done, when all the hard work of now trying to figure out where we go from here begins, and that is not necessarily guaranteed to be in a positive and good direction. And I think that's where you are in Ukraine. And we may have not wanted this to become a big geopolitical issue, but it is definitely one for the Russians. I agree that they are unlikely, unless they really feel provoked, to roll tanks into Ukraine. But I can guarantee you that if you are the SVR resident in Kiev right now, the head of Russian intelligence there, that your list of requirements from Moscow is largely a list of ways to influence the Ukrainian government, to apply pressure, to blackmail people, to buy people, and to make sure this goes the way that Moscow wants.
I mean, you could see a thing. We only have a few minutes left here, so very quickly, Taras and John, I think we very quickly could see the dividing of Ukraine from Russian-influenced sectors and the Western Ukraine, and that could easily, I think, be what we end up seeing. Taras?
No, I think this is, again, this has been an exaggerated journalistic theme for the last 20 years, and separatism in East Ukraine is simply a misnomer. Crimea, yes, it's a separate case. It's an autonomous region with an ethnic Russian majority, but let's not forget there's also an added complexity there of a large Tatar minority, which is, has strong support in Turkey. So Crimea, yes, but the idea of two linguistic parts splitting is extremely fanciful.
Go ahead, John.
Yeah, I agree that it's not likely that despite the fact that you do have this you know, Russian-Ukrainian divide, there is not a clear division that would allow the country to split, except for Crimea, and there the Tatar population is definitely problematic in that regard because the Tatars are more inclined to be favorable to Ukraine.
But in the last election, the party that won, and they could. So I'm saying there is this political divide over how you define what the Ukraine is.
There is. There certainly is that. But the support for some kind of integration into Putin's project of a Eurasian Union has about 25% support. It tends to be very regionally based. Donetsk, Crimea, it tends to be pretty much people with a nostalgia for the Soviet Union, old age pensioners, for example, whereas and who are not really active in civil society. The people who are pro-European tend to be, as always, everywhere involved in civil society, tend to be middle-class students, more educated people. So it's a divide along socioeconomic age groups. But yes, the new leadership in Ukraine has to reach out in some degree to eastern Ukrainians. Klitschko, the international boxer here, maybe has an advantage because he's a Russian speaker, not a Ukrainian speaker.
Right.
And he has support in East Ukraine, particularly amongst the middle class, the young emerging middle class and young people. And he's a clean face. I mean, he didn't make his money by theft. I mean, he made his money by boxing people. So he's not typical for that region as somebody who stole money from the government.
Well, I want to thank all of you. This has been fascinating. We appreciate you all taking your time. Our listeners look forward to having you rejoin us, Dr. Taras Kuzio, John Quigley, Sam Faddis. This has been really a fascinating discussion. You've shed a lot of light, which I appreciate deeply. Thank you so much for joining
us
here.
Bye-bye for now.
And we're going to take a very brief break, and when we come back, it is time for our weekly look at the environment, our future of our food, and more on Soundbites. And we will be looking at the question of hunger among 6 million senior citizens in America. What does that mean, and how does it play out here in the state of Maryland? We'll be looking at the battle over the tax on per head chicken tax that is being debated in Annapolis that would affect companies like Purdue, and look at the battle over the liquid natural gas facility taking place in Cove Point. Stay with us. We'll be right back.